Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, the crisis of local journalism and how philanthropy is offering a lifeline. Then, a new poll reveals what Floridians think about abortion, marijuana, and the presidential race. And a local theater pulls back the curtain on their latest production just in time for the holidays. Plus, music, champagne, and shopping. Create Jax brings us the week's can't-miss events. But first, it's often said that journalism is history in a hurry. But the decline of local journalism over the past 20 years has outpaced what anyone in the business thought possible. The challenge of sustaining and restoring local news is the focus of the emerging world of journalism philanthropy. And I have two experts in the field joining me to discuss this today. Margaret Sullivan is an award-winning media critic and former Washington Post columnist. She was also the first woman appointed as public editor at the New York Times and is the author of two books. The most recent is Ghosting the News, Local Journalism, and the Crisis of American Democracy. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks very much, Anne. Great to be here.
I'm also joined by David McGowan, himself a recovering journalist, but current president and CEO of WJCT. Nice to have you here.
Good morning, Anne.
Do you have questions or concerns about the state of local journalism? Are you worried that stories are being missed or overlooked as newsrooms contract and shrink? Join our conversation. Give us a call at 549-2937. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Message us on Facebook or Instagram, or tag us on X at FCC On Air. Margaret Sullivan, you start your book with a kind of small story with big significance. It's about a Freedom of Information Act request and a sort of inexplicable bonus to a local public official. Can you share that with us?
Sure. So, you know, at a local newspaper, you're constantly sort of trying to dig under the surface of what's happening in the news. And in this case, there'd been a firing of a small town sheriff. And, you know, we dug into that by filing a Freedom of Information request. And, it turned up a lot of information that the public really needed to have that they never, ever would have had if we didn't have the skills to sort of go digging for it. It's not that the public can't do an FOI. It's just that they just generally don't. And if they did, they wouldn't have any place to go with it.
And you had to fight for that. It wasn't just that they gave you the records when you made the request. Is that right?
Absolutely. And that happens so often that you have to resort to a lawsuit or you have to get your lawyers on the case, something other than just, hey, would you please give us this information? It has to be a little more aggressive and sometimes, you know, confrontational. And that's okay.
So the focus of your book is what's happening in local journalism and possible resolutions or ways to alleviate the crisis. You talk about news deserts and news poverty. What do we know about what's happening in areas where there are no papers or very limited sources of news information?
So this concept of a news desert is a place, and it can be a region or a city or, you know, small town that really has very little or no access to local news. If they ever had a weekly newspaper or, you know, a daily newspaper or something else, it's gone away. And so the people living there really don't have good sources of information. They may have, a Facebook, and they may be sharing rumors, or they may be sharing facts. But what they don't have is verified and sort of professionally provided local news. And what we know about that is when news deserts develop, there's less civic engagement. There's more polarization. People go into their echo chambers, and there's more potential for corruption because there's no watchdog there to say, hey, wait a minute, or even just to sit in the room when public officials are having their meetings. When there is no witness, you know, a lot of bad stuff can happen. And so as a result, you'll see the cost of municipal bonds rise, for example, in those areas. So it's overall, it's pretty bad.
David McGowan, these aren't small concerns. Research has shown really these very tangible impacts that Margaret just mentioned, decline in voter turnout, the cost of government increases, which I think a lot of people would be really surprised to hear. People tend to vote more on a party line as opposed to individually on a ballot. Things get more partisan. So talk about some of those impacts and what it is that WJCT is doing to further the cause of local journalism.
Sure. I'd like to start out by just talking about this concept of news deserts and what I've come to call the news scrublands, which are really places where we still have a local newspaper. Margaret, I'm not sure if you coined this term, the ghost newspapers, really, where there's so much less local reporting than there used to be. And my concern has been the impact in those kinds of places. We're talking about, in many cases, mid-sized cities down to smaller cities that really don't have anymore the local reporters on the ground that need to cover the region and all of its complexity. And one of the problems that you have in cities of that size is that, you know, the mechanics of municipal government are pretty similar in most metro areas, right? We all have police departments or sheriff departments, fire departments, a variety of city agencies. But because the scale of our local news coverage is often related to the size of the city, once you get below kind of cities in the top 20 markets in the United States, you really find that today, for a whole variety of reasons, which we can talk about, you just don't have adequate numbers of reporters able to provide the kind of watchdog coverage that Margaret just referred to. And so about 5 years ago, we recognized that problem here in Jacksonville. I think many of our listeners will be familiar with the idea that the Florida Times Union, which has been such a vital contributor to our civic life here over many, many decades, has become one of these kind of ghost newspapers. And I say this, you know, not in any way gleefully, and we depend, and you know, you depend many weeks on reporters doing still great work at the Florida Times Union. Nate Monroe was on the air the other day. David Bauerlein is here frequently. We depend as a city on the work that those reporters do. But the fact is that that newsroom is well reduced and can no longer, by its own admission, cover many of the beats, whether that's education or environment and resilience that they used to and that we need covered. So about 5 years ago, we here began the work of responding to that that crisis in local news right here in Jacksonville by beginning to develop the resources and expand the resources and committing really the organization to playing a more vital role in our local news ecosystem.
And that's Jacksonville Today. Is that in a nutshell kind of where that is taking place?
So there are two things that we did. One of those things is commit more resources to this radio station. So, again, we introduced in 2020 local newscasts throughout the day. The local newscast that you just heard on the air a few minutes ago, we used to do those only in drive time. Now we do them throughout the day. We committed more resources to this program, to First Coast Connect, and we added about 14 hours weekly of new news radio programming to this radio station. But the largest and most visible thing that we've done is we committed ourselves to creating a brand new digital-first, devotedly nonpartisan local news outlet called Jacksonville Today. We started about 2 years ago with a local daily newsletter. And then about a year ago, we introduced a full news website. The key there, of course, is building out the reporting. We've added reporters dedicated to that specific platform. And I think we have to recognize that while we feel it's going well, it is still an effort that is not yet capable of providing the coverage that this city and its residents deserve in order to, you know, participate in civic life in the way that we hope everyone will.
Margaret, in your book, you go to places all over the country that are trying different ways to approach, you know, repopulating that news desert. Some of it is a nonprofit model. There's a variety of them out there. Talk a little bit about your exploration of possibilities.
Well, the thing that I found out is that we have to kind of get over our idea that local newspapers are going to come back in all their glory. I mean, when I became editor of the Buffalo News, I inherited a newsroom of 200 people. And by the time I left, it was down to 145, and now it's well below 100, probably closer to 50. And as David says, you just can't do the work anymore. So I went looking for places that are, you know, being innovative. And it's all kinds of things. I mean, there are digital-first newsrooms that are nonprofit There are collaborations, like one in Pennsylvania called Spotlight PA, in which different news organizations participate in covering particularly state government, state house coverage, which has been really important and really lacking. So collaboration, philanthropy, digital first outlook, the rise of public media, public TV and public radio in trying to fill this gap. So, you know, I mean, I even found a place in East Lansing, Michigan, in which a woman who really wasn't a journalist, but had a PhD in some unrelated subject, you know, started up a news organization and basically trained retirees and, I guess, I hope this isn't a pejorative, but housewives, to go out and cover public meetings. And it's been, you know, they've really turned up a lot of news. I mean, one of the things that you find out is that when you don't have local news coverage, you don't know what you don't know. So there are stories there that East Lansing Information, as it's called, was able to turn up just because they went to these meetings that would have gone unreported.
I remember just covering meetings in my own reporting. There was a particular environmental committee that nobody went to, but every time you went, it was an incredible story. And I was shocked at the kind of stories that that woman's outlet was turned. I mean, they were really consequential stories.
Absolutely. And you know, so I've been asked, well, could that be duplicated in every city? And the answer to that is kind of no, because she has a particular talent or point of view. And when I asked her that question, she said, well, there could be other, you know, other people have different strengths. There could be a great videographer, for example, who would start up an organization that would emphasize that. So I think we're in a time when innovation is really important, awareness, and certainly the ability of and the willingness of philanthropists to pitch in and to say, this is really important right now, and we need to take care of it.
I want to take a call. Mark from the South Side has a comment about local news on television. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead. You're on First Coast Connect.
Hey, good morning. I just want to make a comment. You know, we tune into some of the local news channels, and inevitably, whenever they start off with an international thing. You know, what's going on with Israel and Hamas? Then they break into maybe a child that was abducted in New Mexico or a fire in California, not minimalizing those events or anything, but it doesn't have any kind of an impact on me here locally. And back in the old days, you turned on the local news first for a half hour, and they talked about local issues, and then at 6:30, the NBC nightly news came on, and that kind of thing. I guess my question is, isn't there a way that we, by choice, local news stations, WJCT, could have 30 minutes devoted to local issues? And I think if I tune into to Channel 4, Channel 12, whatever it might be, and the first couple of stories I hear have absolutely nothing to me, I kind of tune it out. You know, I'd rather listen to something local, whether it be politics or sports or, you know, something positive happening in our community, rather than hearing what's happening up in Tacoma, Washington on a given day.
Thank you,
that
Mark.
That was just my comment.
Appreciate your call. Margaret, what do you think about that?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. And, you know, we have many sources of national news. Sometimes it feels like too many. And, you know, everything from cable TV of various stripes to, you know, all the big national newspapers. What we don't have is sufficient local news. So I think to the extent possible, local outlets and TV stations are a prime example of this, should be doing local news more. And what you find out is that, well, that takes people. I mean, the way to produce stories is you have to staff meetings. You have to brainstorm with your editors. It's very labor intensive, and labor costs money. And I suspect that that's what's behind this use of more easily accessible, what we used to call wire copy, that came from other places and was there for the taking. Local news done right is expensive and time consuming.
And there is this appetite out there still for what's going on. And you can see it on some platforms that have in their own way undercut local news, like Nextdoor. You know, very often you'll see people posting, why isn't the news reporting this? You know, why haven't we seen this on the news? You talk about ghost papers. I know that the St. Augustine Record, which, you know, one time had a very robust staff, I think it might have one reporter now, and that's the fastest growing county in Florida.
Right. I mean, that's disastrous, in my opinion, and it's wrong. And so I hope what will happen in a place like that, and maybe it's already happened, I don't know, is that somebody will come along and say there's a void here. and I'm going to start up the, you know, the St. Augustine, you know, Gazette or something, but it'll be all digital. It will be funded through membership and philanthropy and perhaps some advertising, although not usually, and start to fill in the void, because one reporter in a good sized city is it's a ridiculous idea.
Yeah, it is really hard to imagine trying to cover a county like that. Why is philanthropy a good solution, David McGowan? Why does it fit that need that's there for covering local news?
Well, I don't think philanthropy is the only solution, but I think it's a part of the equation. And I think one of the things that we are trying to do is to educate our region about the effects of not having adequate local news coverage. And I think when you start to think about what those effects are and you start to think about journalism as more of a social good than a business, you start to realize that philanthropy often plays a role in stepping into different situations where the private sector no longer has a business model to support an activity. And we can think about that in many different sectors. I mean, the most traditional sectors like our symphony, for example, you know, depends partly on philanthropy. It also depends on ticket sales. But philanthropy helps provide a service, a social good to our community where a straight commercial model would not. And I think that's where we are in journalism. It's important to, I think, remember why this happened, right? All of our reading habits have changed. We all get our news to some degree on these little things we carry around with us all day. The business model that supported our local newspapers is, as Margaret has said, I think is irreparably broken. They're not coming back. Television, local television news, it was interesting the caller referred to that, you know, faces different stresses on its business model, but also is not in a position really to invest meaningfully in providing more reporting on the ground. And so if we value that, if we decide as a community that that's important because it's helped inform voters, it helps with people, you know, that attending public meetings, for example, is a good thing, that kind of accountability is important, then we have to think about how to provide the resources to do that. And we're trying here to build something sustainable. We feel we're on a very good path. We feel that's working. But philanthropy is a key part of that funding model. And I think it's going to be for some time. There's a lot of debate and conversation about this and the role of philanthropy going forward. Margaret is in town today to participate in a session organized by the Community Foundation of Northeast Florida, and we're very grateful to them for convening that session, really to talk about the importance of local news with our local philanthropy community, who may not be aware of the problem.
We've got a call, Mark, on the west side. It sounds like he is aware of the problem. Good morning, Mark. You're on First Coast Connect.
Oh, my God, I'm just screaming at you guys. Born and raised here in Jacksonville, 63 years ago. I remember when there was every radio station had news at the top and the bottom of the hour. And I miss those days. But one thing, and I would happily pay a subscription fee every month to get a lot of local news. But something just you don't think about is that, like the Jaguars right now, they're going these negotiations somewhere with somebody at some times that they're going to extract a billion plus dollars in taxpayer money. And, there are two sides of this issue, good and bad. And is it good for the city? Is it not? But you don't know. There's nobody even talking about it. Nobody brings it up. It's more like just, you're echoing in the wind. It's just, everything you hear about it is like it's going on. And it's proceeding, and the mayor's looking for a solution. But you don't hear about, well, there's possibly a bad side to this, and here's what's where all this money might lead us, and things like that. It's just it's just covered superficially, if not at all. It just drives me crazy.
Mark, thanks so much for your comments. Margaret, your thoughts?
So I think that's absolutely right, Mark. It's one thing to sit in a public meeting or to go out and cover an air show. It's another thing to dig under the surface with a skeptical point of view and say, is this a good, you represent the public interest, journalists should. And so to be asking the questions that you're asking, is this a good expenditure? How is it being spent? Is it being done properly? All those kinds of questions. And those require a kind of expertise that you're not going to get on Nextdoor, which may have its value, but you're not going to get sort of the ability to dig and to question and to, you know, sustain it and to talk with the lawyer and make sure that the work is right. And I just like to make one other point, which is that local news is more trusted. And at a time when trust in the media is down, it's really important not to lose that.
I saw a recent study that the Pew Research did about, you know, trust in local media. And I thought it was interesting that they found that for the Black community in particular, that local news is more trusted than the national news, and that they really look to local news to tell the story of the Black community more fairly and more honestly.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's happened, and this is one of the benefits of the internet age and the social media age, is that we have more voices out there. It's not just the paper and the TV station or whatever it may be. Now we have bloggers and we have commentators and we have smaller news organizations that may have a different constituency. And that's the democratization of media that is a plus of this time that we're in.
And I think it's also a time to be optimistic in a lot of ways, because as we seek to rebuild the reporting capacity in Jacksonville and in other communities across the country, one of the things that I think that people who are involved in this space are actively thinking about is not rebuilding a local newspaper, because local newspapers had plenty of problems. They didn't cover certain communities very well. They were subject to a very top-down kind of model of what was deciding what was important to cover. And I think as we build these new services, we have this fantastic opportunity to really think about what a local journalism source should be, how it should function, what it should cover, how those decisions should be made. All of that is happening in this kind of laboratory where there is a lot of innovation going on. We're excited to be part of that, but there is a lot of work to be done.
It's interesting, Margaret, in your book, you talk about these digital first, sometimes philanthropic news efforts, not necessarily being appropriate to try to put on an existing newspaper model, that they have some legacy costs and things that make that a difficult application. Can you talk about that? I mean, why is it that the nonprofit model doesn't just go to the local paper and help out?
Right. I mean, that has happened in a couple of cities, and it's the jury's out on whether that's going to work. But if you are to start up a nonprofit digital first organization, you don't have to buy ink. You don't need any presses. You're probably not going to have unions to deal with. You don't have big overhead of a building that was really built for a different era. So you can be leaner, and I don't know about meaner, but you can certainly be, I don't know whether meaner is good in this context or not, but you can be leaner and more efficient. And so there's a benefit there.
I want to ask you about that too, because in your book, you talk about, I mean, right now we know there's a lot of labor disputes in every area, but certainly, you know, the newspaper industry is one of them. You quote one of your former investigative reporters as saying, all good work is done in defiance of management.
Yes. Well, I was both a reporter and a union member, and then I became the dreaded management at the Buffalo News. And so I sat on both sides of the table. And, you know, I think that's a funny comment. And it's something that this particular reporter, it typifies his attitude. And he did a lot of great work. But I actually think that reporters and their managers or editors should be and often are on the same side, which is the side of good journalism, and that when they work together, they can get it done.
I feel like I shouldn't toss that to my big boss.
No, don't even think about
it. I mean, look, newsrooms are notoriously rambunctious and sometimes rebellious places. And for the most part, that's a good thing because, as Margaret described, an attitude of skepticism is often a very useful trait as you approach a public meeting or any elected official. So, you know, I think that just kind of comes with the territory.
The importance of digging, attending meetings where there's consequential things happening, that's a big deal. But newspapers traditionally have had a broader role in the community in terms of just creating, I think you call it at least a shared reality or a shared narrative, cultural events, music, reviews, all of the things that, even if it's just, you know, pictures of sports teams winning, a sense of community.
Right. I mean, it's a newspaper has traditionally been something that has helped knit the community together in a really important way. And that was because, you know, everybody on your street got the paper. And so you could all sort of talk about the same things and you had a shared reality. And now that simply doesn't happen anymore. And we are in our echo chambers. And to a large extent, we can't talk to each other. And so when we think about how democracy works, democracy depends on a common ground of truth. Well, do we have a common ground of truth? And how does news, and specifically how does local news enter into that, is one of the issues that I'm really concerned about.
And you know, it's interesting that you point out that kind of breadth of coverage and those other kinds of topics that are important. And I think I'd be remiss if I didn't kind of give a shout out to this program, right, which is going to have, you know, arts coverage later on in this very hour and does that virtually every day. Jacksonville Today, one of the things that we decided early on is that we were going to provide all kinds of different coverage. The watchdog and investigative work is very important. It's at the heart of what we all know that we need to do. But we also have to build an audience for that. And it's not always true that everyone wants to take the medicine of reading the hard-hitting story about a city council meeting. Sometimes you need to be drawn into that by a story about a football game or a restaurant review or a concert you want to go to or whatever it might be. And those things provide kind of the fabric that and the kind of ecosystem of a news product that is compelling.
Not just eat your vegetables. We've got a call from Adam in Murray Hill. Good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hey, I just wanted to comment on how news is perceived in our current era and how, you know, between everything that's just actual information is a lot of times deemed fake news or deemed leftist or elitist. And I feel like that is one of the main reasons that so many people just don't tune into the news now, is they just see it as false information. I also think that social media plays a huge role into why a lot of people are just tuned out to the actual news. When you have things like News for Jax, that is just their social media is just clickbait. But I'll take my comment off air. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
So Adam's absolutely right. And one of the really frustrating things about being a journalist these days, or being part of what I call the reality-based press, is that when you are reporting factual information, it's dismissed, or it's called, you know, deeply biased, or it's tagged fake news. And this has gone from the national level to the local level, so that you can be a TV reporter going out to cover a school board meeting and have people screaming at you that you're fake news. And that's, you know, very destructive, I think. And it just worries me. So, but I do come back to the fact that even within that somewhat troubled ecosystem, it's local news that does a little bit better. And that is partly because, you know, we might know the person who's behind the camera, or we might know the person behind the notebook, or we might, you know, our child might go to school with that person's child. There's a connection that you don't get when you're watching, let's say, CNN.
I know that David said that there was some optimism in, and that's great. But even some of the people that you interviewed for this book, who are doing well or are doing better, weren't particularly optimistic. You talked to Walter Hussman Jr., who's the publisher of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and he's actually been able to keep his publication pretty strong. He said, quote, "I'm real pessimistic. I'm afraid that 5 to 6 years out, we're going to end up with no local newspapers. And I'll tell you what, it's going to be a field day for corruption."
Well, you know, Walter is in the newspaper world, and he's not wrong about that. I mean, newspapers haven't disappeared, but they are definitely weakened. And that's why we need to look to these other models to fill the gap. And it doesn't happen overnight, and we have to throw a lot of things up against the wall and see what sticks. But I think David said that he is optimistic. I would scale that back a little from my point of view and say that I'm hopeful. So I think there's a lot of good things happening. I'm hopeful, and I'm also worried.
It's called Ghosting the News, Local Journalism and the Crisis of American Democracy. Margaret Sullivan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for the great conversation.
David McGowan, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with how Floridians are thinking about issues in the upcoming election. And we're back. The University of North Florida's Public Opinion Research Lab released the results of its most recent poll this morning. Registered voters across Florida responded to a series of questions on both state and local policy issues, as well as candidate favorability. I'm joined by Michael Binder. He's the faculty director at the University of North Florida's Public Opinion Research Lab. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us first, what is the Public Opinion Research Lab at UNF?
So we are a public-facing survey organization at the university, and as you've been paying attention over the last, 8 or 10 years or so, we've done a lot of public opinion polling on political issues, both locally, statewide, and nationally. But we also do a myriad of other work for state agencies that never sees the light of day, or for private companies. Media is not as interested in those things, but that's a lot of the work that we do, and we employ a great number of students, and we're, I think, contributing a great deal to the dialogue locally and across the state.
You and I have talked in the past, it's gotten harder in some ways to do polling. Explain some of the challenges and how you work around those.
Yeah, it's more difficult to reach people. And, every time you see a phone number that you don't recognize on your cell phone, it's easy not to answer. It's easy not to look at emails. It's easy to disregard texts. And part of that is the bad actors out there with phishing, and people are skeptical and people are concerned. And certain folks denigrate polling if it's a result that they don't like, and that contributes to the weakening of the industry. But we're out there fighting every day, finding new ways to try and reach people, and by doing what we think is solid, honest work to help increase trust in the processes and give citizens an opportunity to have their voice heard if they don't have the ability to be connected directly to politicians because they donate a pile of money.
Okay, so I realize I'm completely burying the lead here. You've got poll results. Let's talk about some of them. What stood out to you most?
So I think a couple of things. One, we asked favorability on the candidates, and Trump and DeSantis were not great. They were about even, roughly, the kind of 48-49 approval and disapproval range. But the thing that kind of struck me was how poorly Joe Biden's doing as far as favorability goes in the state. And, 34% favorable, 63% unfavorable. That doesn't bode well going into an election. I think those are probably two of the bigger ones.
So those are surprising to you. And of course, the poll doesn't tell you why, but you're a political science professor. What are your thoughts about Biden's numbers?
Well, I mean, if you're thinking about an election, it's not great. If you're thinking about what that means for the outcome of the election, I think it matters less. Joe Biden's in a place where he doesn't really need Florida to win, but he does need some other states to win. And I think his approval numbers aren't great overall, but I think once the election comes into focus and it's one person versus another, a lot of times those numbers kind of come up as Democrats will come home.
What else did you choose to poll about, and how do you make those decisions?
Well, we also asked about the potential abortion amendment and also the recreational marijuana potential amendment. They're theoretically going to be on the ballot in the fall. And we try to pick issues that are meaningful to Florida voters, maybe before the state legislature, maybe coming up on an upcoming ballot. It was difficult this year because the state legislature is meeting so early, but they didn't really have a lot of big issues that were out there. And so it was difficult for us to find things that are being talked about in Tallahassee with specificity. So we looked to the November election, and these are obviously issues that we've asked about in the past. They're issues that matter to Floridians, and that's why we asked about them. But unsurprising, the support for recreational marijuana is high, as we say in our press release.
I see what you did there.
With 67% supporting it. And, you know, as a note, Florida needs 60% for these state ballot measures to pass. So 60 is a high bar, and at 67%, that bodes well at this point. The other one we looked at is the abortion amendment, which is obviously before the court and getting looked at, but it would prevent the state from passing laws banning abortion prior to viability. And that even had 62% approval. And the real striking tidbit in that is, if you look under the hood a little bit, Republicans were supportive at 53% to 39%. And this is something that we've seen over the time in Florida. Republicans aren't nearly as anti-abortion in this state as maybe they are in some of the other states around the country. And there's been a window for support for some pro-choice policies in this state.
And if that lands on the ballot, if it gets approved and gets the signatures that it needs, do you think that that's going to be a driving force in voter turnout?
Well, because it'll be on a general election when there's a presidential race, there's not really a lot of room to increase turnout, right? There's so much attention, there's so much media, there's so much awareness, there's so much effort to get people out. These types of ballot measures tend to be more influential in midterms when you have a large chunk of the voter electorate that may vote in a presidential election but not in a midterm, and then they can be pushed to show up in a midterm if the issues are right. In presidential elections, there's not a lot of empirical evidence over time that suggests that these issues will make meaningful contributions to the turnout margins.
Michael Binder, faculty director at UNF's Polling Lab, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned. Up next, we talk performance with actors from the Artist Connection Theater. Welcome back. Artist Connection Theater is a family-operated, nonprofit community theater in Jacksonville's Arlington neighborhood. Their latest production, A White Christmas, premieres this Friday, December 1st at 7:30 p.m. I'm joined now by a couple of actors and the director, Hattie Berwind. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. Harrison Newton, one of the actors in the performance.
Yes. Hi, everyone.
And Joe Mora, another actor in the performance.
Hello. Happy holiday.
I should tell you all, everybody's wearing a Santa hat while they're here today, so appreciate the holiday spirit. So thanks for coming. What is the story behind the theater? Why Arlington? How did the theater get started, Hattie?
So my mom, back in 2012, she really wanted to give a theater to our community in the Arlington area, because we were very active as kids, and she could never find anything. So she wanted to give, in our area anyways, so she wanted to give our area a more, like, a local theater that everybody could come to and audition, no matter what artistic background you had. And, yeah, she just wanted to give that to everybody.
So you were a family of theater kids?
Yeah, theater, singing, dancing, yep. Everything.
Yeah. And I think she talked about the fact that, you know, the cost can be prohibitive when you have a bunch of kids that are all interested in doing theater. So how does this theater help fill that need?
Yes. So nobody has to pay anything to be in the show. We do ask that they provide help with costumes mainly. Mm-hmm. And then everything else, sets, all the materials we need is all we get all through donations and ticket sale. And things like that.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe, I saw White Christmas not long ago myself at a theater production at a school.
Yeah.
But tell me what role you play and what a little bit about what you're doing in this theater company?
Sure. Yeah. For this show, I'm a choreographer, so I'm doing the dances as well as one of the lead actors, Phil Davis. So Phil is he's a romantic and well, he kind of plays with females' hearts, and then Cupid catches up to him and he falls in love, and a lot of singing and dancing. Oh, and also we're army veterans coming out of World War II. So all of that in the show, mixed with a lot of classic Christmas crooning.
Yeah, Harrison, tell us a little bit about the production for people who aren't familiar with White Christmas.
Sure. Yeah, so it's it's based on a book, White Christmas, and then that book was turned into a movie where Bing Crosby played Bob Wallace, which is who I'm going to be playing in the show. And then the musical was based off of that. And it was the first production of it was in St. Louis in the early 2000s. And then it opened on Broadway in 2008 and 2009. So it's a fairly modern musical, which I didn't know. The movie preceded the musical. And it was very fascinating for me. But it makes sense with some of the jokes that are in there. It's not period to the 50s, but it's a really but all in all, it's a really family friendly show. It talks about the spirit of Christmas and giving and seeing someone who's your friend who's in need and giving up your personal vendettas in order to make someone else happy.
Is this your first time with ACT, or have you done other shows previously?
No. I helped my mom kind of fill cast roles in the beginning. I have a semi-professional background in music. I attended the University of North Florida for vocal performance. I didn't finish my degree, but I did experience a lot of professional environments. And so being there, I helped my mom kind of, I guided her in the right direction as to what normally takes place in a theater. And so since then, I've kind of offered my talents to the theater, and we did Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat earlier this year, and I played Joseph in that, and I also helped with directing the music. So I'm just very involved in this theater, and I'm happy to be involved because this is my community. I grew up here. These are my people, and I want to give them something that they can be proud of. I think we all do, my mom, who's the founder, included. And so, you know, being able to do that, you know, and balancing work life, you know, we don't get paid for this. It's all volunteer work. So balancing work life and home life, and but being happy about doing it is it's really good.
Hattie, what is the goal in terms of being there in Arlington and being a community for Arlington?
Just to bring something the whole family can be a part of, because we have a wide range of cast members in age. Like we got 8-year-old auditioning and 80-year-old auditioning. Like, it's for everybody, and we definitely want to bring our community together in that way. That's our main goal.
Well, thank you, Joe Mora, Harrison Newton, Hattie Berwin, for being here today. We appreciate it. White Christmas premieres this Friday, December 1st at 7:30 p.m. Good luck to y'all. Break a leg.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be back in just a minute with what Create Jax has on deck for next week.
Hi, join me, Ira Flatow, at the WJCT Studios for an evening of enlightening and engaging conversation with WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan. That's on Tuesday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. For tickets and additional information, go to wjct.org/events. I look forward to seeing you there.
Ireland, the birthplace of many poets and writers, wordsmiths for the ages, like Dublin author Paul Lynch.
To quote the apocryphal Gospels, if you use what is within you, what is within you will save you.
We ask why Tiny Ireland manages to produce so many literary stars. The power of the Irish pen, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Scott Tong. For high school seniors, applying to college is increasingly competitive at the elite schools, and oh, the stress.
A lot of the pressure that I experience comes from myself. Applying for college and wanting to get in somewhere good, and you know, it's really stressful.
We hear from two seniors smack in the middle of application season. Next time in Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
What happens when a trendy tech startup offering solutions to help underserved cities goes under? Ask Fresno. It's dealing with the fallout from the collapse of Bitwise, and that's focusing minds in the Central Valley.
Don't let one failed company define you, because those people that work there are amazing and they're brilliant, and we believe in them.
That story next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. For those of you who want to get out of the house this week but aren't sure where to begin, fret not. Create Jax has got you covered. Yaya Cardona and her tiny pup Mambo are here with this week's carefully crafted list of Jacksonville's must-attend events. Welcome.
Buenos dias. Good morning.
Great to have you, Yaya. So first of all, congratulations. There was a proclamation you received from Mayor Donna Deegan for the Viva La Fiesta.
Yes, thank you so much. It's an incredible honor. As you guys know, Viva La Fiesta was our 5th year anniversary. It's the only Hispanic festival, and it was an incredible honor to get this proclamation. October 15th in Jacksonville, from now on, will be known as Viva La Fiesta.
Beautiful. Can't wait for the next one. So let's start with some of the week's events and some that are starting this weekend. What's on the calendar?
And remember, you guys can find the full list of all the events and even events that we're not going to mention on the on Tony's website on createjax.com, which is C-R-E, the number 8, jax.com. You can also follow him on Instagram and Facebook, but his website is where you can submit events and you can see the full list of events. All right. So shout out to Tony for doing that.
And also get to know some local artists and people in the community. It's like got a good informational meet the folks kind of element. So.
And he also has like for artists that wants to find out grants, you can find out there.
Auditions.
So many amazing things you can really find out. All cool things going on Create Jax website, C-R-E, the number 8, Jax. All right, so let's start off with what's going on this Saturday, December 2nd. It's the Jax Record and CD Festival. I am excited about this. It's at UNF. It's completely free from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Jacksonville Record and CD Festival at the North Florida Best Music Collector Show. They'll have all kind of vinyl records, CD, cassette tapes, albums, CD storage supplies, all the things you could think of, memorable and collectible items.
New and used?
New and used, uh-huh.
You get your good vinyl there?
Yeah, I collect vinyls. And we even have a podcast called Next Spin, so it's pretty dope. We should check it out. Have you ever had anybody made you like a love cassette tape like back in the day?
Oh, mixtapes? Hell yeah. That was a big deal.
I miss those. We need to bring those back. All right, so if you're definitely into that, check that out. That's this Saturday for free. Also this Saturday, we have at the Phoenix Art District. This is one of my favorite things. I will be there. It's the Holiday Artist and Maker Market. Guys, this is really cool. This is free. This is kid, family friendly and pet friendly, okay? From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. is the inaugural Holiday Artist and Maker Market. It's collaborating with the historic East Side to bring you over 50 small makers and artists showcasing their creations right in time for the holidays. So, guys, if you don't have any ideas for, like, holiday gifts or anything like this, this is great. If you're even within a budget, you could work with them. You get to meet local artists. And I, for one, love unique gifts.
Well, also, if you haven't checked out the Phoenix Art District, my producer, Stacy, and I got to check out some of that space the other day, a couple weeks ago. And it's so cool. And
everything that they're doing there.
And they're going to have Naked Kitchen, which is a great restaurant, really yummy curry that they served us. So
yeah, that was really good. And they're going to have kava and food, vendors, lots of art. So check that out. That's going to be free this Saturday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Phoenix Art District. Also, we have Intuition 13th Anniversary. So shout out to Intuition Outworks. Aleworks. It's from 12 p.m. to 10 p.m. It's completely free. We're so excited to announce that the Patterson Hood will be headlining the anniversary party on December 2nd at the Bear Hall. So check that out. All right.
Good stuff. Patterson Hood was my first post-COVID concert, like after that whole long dry spell.
Uh-huh. So that was good.
He's awesome.
I can only imagine all the energy you left out that night. Also, for all our families that are looking something to do this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, you have the Jacksonville Christmas Spectacular at the Ritz Theater. There is a cost. It's $55. The Jacksonville Christmas Spectacular evening of three hilarious, heartwarming stories and one show off Broadway producer Jason Woods begins this year, perfect for the child and anyone. All right, so check that out. The opening night, Mayor Donna Deegan will be the guest to MC. All right, so we have the last couple of things. We're just going to mention them, okay? On December 2nd, we have the opening of Through the Lens is the art gallery from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And on Sunday, we have the Slow Food Farm Tour, which is four farms. I know you went to it and you loved that.
Yeah, it was terrific. Don't miss it. It's a really good time.
And in Springfield on December 8th and the 9th, we have the Holiday Home Tour Historic Springfield. That's $15. Remember, you can check out the full list of all the events at createjax.com.
What is on your list, Yaya? Where are you headed?
I am definitely going to the historic Springfield this Saturday. I'm not going to miss that. I definitely want to check out the Slow Food Farm tours because I love to eat. So
there's good food, and they also have things that engage kids. Like, it's fun to bring kids to. They let you play with food and make stuff, and so it really is a neat time.
Yeah, last night I went to the Duval and Soil Conservation
District.
Yes, yep. And the gala, and I learned so much of the importance of how we really should be paying attention to what's going on with our soil and our farms locally.
Yaya Cardona, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, guys.
And that's our program. If you missed anything, check out the rebroadcast at 8 p.m. or find today's show at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer, and our director is Brady Corum. Join us again Friday for First Coast Week in Review. We'll be discussing the week's biggest news with our local media gurus. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.